This is Gil Manser welcoming you to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. This evening's Word by Word offers two distinctly different conversations. In the first segment, I will chat about the 5th Annual Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival with the festival's program director Jason Perdue and the critically acclaimed filmmaker Nancy Kelly, whose documentary Trust, Second Acts in Young Lives is featured during the weekend of March 30th through April 1st. Then, in our next segment, I have a conversation with award-winning novelist Ben Marcus about his controversial new novel, The Flame Alphabet. Set in a linguistically deadly parallel universe where parents are literally dying from the sounds and words uttered by their children, a Forest Jew couple which makes weekly visits to their private tabernacle hidden in a wooded burrow. But first, I want to talk about the 5th Annual Documentary Film Festival with Jason Perdue and Nancy Kelly. Jason Perdue was one of the original founders of the festival and now serves as director of film programs at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts. Nancy Kelly has produced and directed independent narrative and documentary films for over a quarter century. Her documentaries include Downside Up, about the creation of the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, and Smitten, about Rene DeRosa and his collection of contemporary artworks by Northern California artists. And as I was reminded off-air, KRCB was a critical part of Smitten.
Because KRCB was involved, we got finishing funds from the Independent Television Service, ITVS, and Smitten was the first film that KRCB ever had that was on the national PBS program, and it is the most frequently aired film that ITVS ever put money into.
Right. And you've also done an interesting film called Downside Up, which kind of went back to your roots in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Because as it says here, that it was a place where your family once worked. So you want to tell us about the abandoned Massachusetts factory?
Yeah, my parents and my family, my godparents, everybody I knew when I was a kid worked at Sprague Electric in North Adams, Massachusetts, which closed its doors in 1984, leaving half the city, half the working population of the city unemployed. And it was empty for the longest time. North Adams went to the dogs. And then I was visiting in 1998, and I heard that what was going to bring the town back to life was America's largest museum of contemporary art. And I'm telling you, I just said to myself, if that is going to happen here, I want to be here to see it. and I started filming that fall and thinking that it was going to be a failure. Because they were saying, I mean, North Adams had about 16,000 people, if that, left. And so it was about
– where is this in relation to the state?
It's in the Berkshires, which is the westernmost
part. So it's not that populated.
Oh, my God, no. And there's like two roads that go in and out of it, not freeways or anything. And the New York Times once told readers in its travel section to make a U-turn before they got to the post-industrial wasteland of North Adams. You know, and yet the museum was saying – they were going to attract over 100,000 people a year from the international art community. And I was just like, right. But in fact, well over now it's, you know, many years later, it's been open for well over 10 years, getting closer to 15. And it has changed the town, changed the people in the town. Even if they don't go to the museum, they just have such a better sense of themselves and of the town. The town was 80% boarded up on the main street when the museum opened, and now it's 20% or less boarded up.
Well, this is a perfect segue into Jason talking about the film festival in Sebastopol, which seems like a kind of unlikely place to have what is considered one of the, is it 20 coolest festivals now?
That's what Movie Maker Magazine just said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah, we're very happy about that. This is actually the second time in 3 years that they picked us as one of those. So, yeah.
Well, we're better. It was 25 last time. Now
right.
They've limited, you know, the list to 20.
So. Right. So I'm very happy about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the film that we're going to be seeing this year from you is called Trust, Second Acts in Young Lives. Tell us how this film you know, you described how you found this factory that was going to be converted. How did you find this project?
Oddly, I found this project as a direct result of having made Downside Up. When I was traveling around showing Downside Up, I screened it in Chicago, and part of the person who hosted that screening asked me what I wanted to do next, and I was like, I don't know. I'm kind of curious about the way that theater changes the lives of kids in, you know, tough neighborhoods, and because I had read this study by this professor Shirley Bryce Heath at Stanford about exactly that, remarkably how effective these after-school theater programs were, and this guy in Chicago said, "Oh, you got to check out the Albany Park Theater Project," which I did immediately, and because this guy Nick Rabkin in Chicago is just one of those people that, you know, when he speaks, I listen. And that's how it got started. And
Trust was awarded the Youth Vision Award by the United Nations Association Film Festival for its moving portrayal of a young woman finding direction, joy, and trust in Chicago's Albany Park Theater Project, a theatrical group that creates original plays from members' real-life stories. But it took you several years for this film to get going until you discovered the perfect young person to feature on screen.
We started this film in 2004, and we literally tried four times to make the documentary. And each time we learned from the failure of what we had tried to do in the first three times what we needed. Because what the Albany Park Theater Project does is actually, it's kind of complex. And I didn't really understand what I needed to film in order to tell their story well. You know, over the years, as the film was not coming together, and people were telling me to give it up, I kept thinking, if I can be there when someone tells his or her story, then you'll know what the roots are.
So tell us how you felt when you found the right person at the right moment.
I knew that day that all we had to do was keep showing up for the theater company to make that, and, you know, and capture them creating a play out of that story, and that we would have a film.
It's a tremendously powerful film. It is called Trust, Second Acts in Young Lives, and you will be there to talk about the film?
Kenji Yamamoto, the editor, producer, and
who
I will
who is a very close relation with you.
My husband.
We'll be there. That, Jason, that's one of the things that makes this Basketball Documentary Film Festival so special, is that we, and even though we are this little teeny town, you know, in West County, people come here from all over the world to share their filmmaking experiences with the audience.
Yeah, I think that's really a key for us. You know, the way I've always looked at it is that it doesn't become a film festival until you have the filmmakers there, because anybody can put together some movies and show them on any given night. But when you have the filmmakers there, you have the interaction with the audience. You have the experience of seeing that whole process and hearing about the process, whether it's about the content of the film or about the filmmaking process or whatever it is. I think that all of a sudden it becomes a film festival.
Right. It's a wonderful – we've added the Thursday night. You want to talk about that a little bit, opening night?
Sure, yeah. We have added Thursday night. This is really kind of a big deal for us. We've always run a program on opening night that was four or five screenings running simultaneously, all in smaller venues. And then we would all gather together at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts for our kind of opening night reception. But this year we've decided to open on Thursday night at Annaly High Auditorium, which, you know, on the floor has about 600 seats. Mm-hmm. And it'll be the first time that we have a really like one big screening on opening night, which is really, you know, kind of one of those film festival experiences that Sebastopol was missing. And I really wanted to be able to do that. And really, I mean, for seeing a film with that many people, potentially that many people, there's really no venue in Sonoma County to do that. Unless you organize it and really put it together. But there's no theaters that are that big. So it's really, I think, going to be a unique experience for our festival, for the town of Sebastopol, and just for for everybody that comes.
And the opening night ticket includes the reception afterwards.
Right. So we are going to still have the reception back at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts like we have in the past, where we will present the awards, our jury award and our critics award, of which Trust is one of our five finalists for the jury award.
But you don't know yet, huh? You don't know whether you're one of the winners yet.
No. And in fact, I have to give Jason the DVDs today for the jurors.
Okay. Well, that would be an important part of this process.
Yes.
Anything else about this weekend or that weekend, the last weekend in March that you want to – that's really different? I mean, I know we have some new venues.
A couple of new venues. I think improvements for us. Where Truss is going to play is actually at Main Stage West, which is the old Sonoma Rep in right on the corner, Main Street and Bodega Avenue in Sebastopol.
Or Beast Pharmacy for the real old timers.
Right, of course. And that's great for us. I mean, I think that's really – it's a great venue. It's right in the center of town. And we're also going to be at the Vets Building this year. So really all of our venues with the theater, with the cinemas and the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, we're all within walking distance this year, which is really kind of an important thing for us.
Right. Well, one of the things also that the festival is noted for is its music. It's live music. And you're going to end on a big, very loud note at the Hop Monk Tavern.
We are. Kind of like last year where we showed a film about the new Master Sounds and they played afterwards. This year we have the film Everyday Sunshine, the story of Fishbone. And this was a band that in the late 80s and early 90s was my absolute favorite band. I saw them in concert many times. And when I heard this movie was kind of out and moving around, I got in touch with the director and we made a plan to bring it up here. And I started working with the band and with Hop Monk, and we arranged to have the band play afterwards. So our closing night again will be we're going to show the movie at Hop Monk, take the screen down, move the chairs out, and Fishbone's going to get on stage and play for us. So yeah,
sounds exciting.
Yeah.
So how can everyone get in contact and get tickets and this wonderful program that you brought with you?
Well, the programs are going to be out here any day, and you're going to see them all over the place. We printed twice as many. It's five times as big as it was in the past, the printed program is. And they're going to be everywhere around Sonoma County. You can go on our website, SebastopolFilmFestival.org.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both of you, Nancy Kelly, Jason Perdue. We appreciate the time to let us know about the fifth annual Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Our second segment on tonight's Word by Word is with author Ben Marcus talking about his linguistically deadly new novel, The Flame Alphabet. Born in 1967, Ben Marcus is the editor of the Anchor Book of New American Short Stories and the author of four books of fiction, The Notable American Women, The Father Costume, The Age of Wire and String, and his newest novel, The Flame Alphabet. He has won many prizes, including a grant for innovative literature from the Creative Capital Foundation, the Morton Dowen Zabel Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Fiction, and three Pushcart Prizes. Marcus is an associate professor in the School of Arts at Columbia University. Ben Marcus, I would like to welcome you to Word by Word.
Thanks for having me.
I have to ask you a question. I picked this book up completely cold, without reading any of the blurbs or the material they sent along with it, so I was somewhat unprepared for what I found. Can you give our listeners a quick overview, if you will, of the characters, time, and place where these things exist?
Sure. The book opens with the narrator Sam and his wife Claire not feeling so well. And they go to doctors and they can't quite figure out what's wrong with them. No one seems to know. And they're getting sicker and sicker. And so are adults around the country. Their teenage daughter goes on a school trip for a couple days, and while she's gone, they start to realize they're feeling a little bit better, and it dawns on them with a little bit of dread that perhaps their illness is connected to her. As she returns, they confirm that, and it's not just her presence, but in fact her speech. So throughout the book, the speech of children is toxic, and adults are faced with a very difficult choice. Stay with the children that they love and are meant to protect, but perish, or flee their children and live with the shame of that. So the book follows the narrator's navigation through that morally complex set of decisions as he ultimately does flee and tries to devise a new language, a new script, a new alphabet that won't actually make people sick.
Mm-hmm. Can I have you read, actually? We're going to –
sure.
It starts in the months before our departure here.
What page
it's,
are we?
It's chapter 3. Well, I have it marked for you, so I've got to begin, start and stop. I've got it real simple. How's that?
In the months before our departure, most of what sickened us came from our sweet daughter's mouth. Some of it she said, and some of it she whispered, and some of it she shouted. She scribbled and wrote it and then read it aloud. She found it in books and in the mail, and she made it up in her head. It was soaked into the cursive script she perfected at school, letters ballooning with heart-dotted eyes, vowels defaced into animal drawings. Each piece of the alphabet that she wrote looked like a fat molecule engorged on air, ready to burst. How so very dear. The sickness washed over us when we saw it, when we heard it, when we thought of it later. We feasted on the putrid material because our daughter made it. We gorged on it, and inside us it steamed, rotted, turned rank. Esther sang as she walked through the house. Her voice was toneless, from the throat, in a frequency high in warding power. A voice with a significant half-life, a noxious mineral content, that is, if it could be frozen and crystallized, something then beyond our means or imagination. If her voice could have been made into a smoke, we would have known. If you heard it, you were thoroughly repelled. She muttered in her sleep and awake. She spoke to us and to others, into the phone, out the window, into a bag. It didn't matter. Nice things, mean things, dumb things. Just a teenager's chatter, like a tour guide to nothing, stalking us from room to room. Blame and self-congratulation, and a constant narration of this, that, and the other thing, in low-functioning, if common, rhetorical modes, in occasions of speech designed not particularly to communicate, but to alter the domestic acoustics, because she seemed to go dull if she wasn't speaking or reading or serving somehow as a great filter of words. She did it without thinking, and she did it to herself, and it was we alone who were sickened. But of course we'd find out it was others too, others and others and others. What she said was bitter, and we sipped at it and sipped at it, her mother and I, just ever so politely sipped at it until we were sick, because this was the going air inside our house, our daughter talking and singing and shouting and writing. Whatever we thought we wanted, to hug or kiss our daughter, to sit near her, it was our bodies that recoiled first. We cowered and leaned away from her words. We kept our distance. But Esther was a gap closer, bringing it all right up to our faces. Some sort of magnet was in effect, a father magnet, a mother magnet. As we fled, Esther gave chase. We covered our ears and she talked louder. Our daughter seemed not to care who was listening, and we were ready at hand, ready to service her needs. We stood up to it and took it like parents, because doesn't the famous phrase say, "Shit on me, oh my children, and I will never fail to love you."
Okay, there's at least three things going on in that passage. One, we find out about the sickness.
Yeah.
About their growing awareness of it and dread of it.
Yeah.
The fact that it is not – they thought at first it might be confined to certain groups or certain geographic areas. They're learning over time that that is not true, that it is widespread and it's affecting all adults. And the word choice – the phraseology, how did that come to be, those sentences on those that you just shared with us?
How did I write them?
Yeah.
You know, I think it came at once in a rush. So I was trying to set up the problem of the book. I think one of the things that gets me started on a novel is to have a character who has, in some sense, a terrible difficulty, a terrible choice, a terrible problem. And I think that's what propelled me with this passage, because when I imagined what it might be like to feel this from my own children, I felt a kind of horror, and I couldn't imagine what I would do or how I could ever come to see my own children as somehow culprits in my undoing.
Mm-hmm.
So the impossibility of this, my inability to imagine it, was in some sense what pushed me to try to envision it in fiction.
Did you write it in the order it exists now, or was this earlier, or what happened?
Yeah, I pretty much wrote it in the order that it's in now. I revised and revised and revised. I wrote a lot more than I needed, it turned out. I went back and cut quite a lot of material. I didn't quite have the end at the beginning as I wanted it. And then in the second and third – in the second part in particular, I took a 70 or 80-page detour,
mm-hmm.
which was fun as detours are. But
good backstory.
I couldn't it was front story,
oh, okay.
actually. And it was just too frontal. And I cut that later. But this was really written in the order that you see it.
It's interesting because this is the section that I stopped and reread.
Okay.
And I did so because I was trying to feel that, if I were the parent of a teen today, mine are a bit older now, but I have a 12-year-old granddaughter, would this work? In other words, without there being the toxicity that you go into detail here, the deadliness of this,
yeah.
There is a something about teenagers talk, and we talked about this off air a little bit, that we all, used to create our own sets of language, and even
sure.
more so now with the the small groups of friends who are now all over the world, but who are communicating in a
yeah.
in shortcut in code in a Morse kind of system that they've developed themselves.
Yeah, I think teenagers are a kind of tribe. Do you mean would the teenager's language be toxic without the conceit of the book that has it be?
Well, I'm wondering if a parent mm-hmm. were to read that and just
I see.
out of the book. Just say it's in a, some
would
magazine.
Would they find it believable
and understand?
I can't answer what other people would feel. I would like to think so. I would like to think.
I think I would agree. I think they would.
And to me, that's an interesting question as well, because as you move into the book, you do get a little bit of backstory before the speech fever, this language plague, has hit. And
mm-hmm.
you see that there's a language problem in the home already,
mm-hmm.
in fact, that the father, the mother, the daughter use language back and forth, sometimes a bit as a weapon, sometimes to hurt each other's feelings. And
their daughter too.
That's right.
And she insulates herself from that.
That's right. And so I thought about how this family already has problems and I'm kind of making the problems worse. And this language toxicity might have struck a family that was perfectly adjusted and happy, and that seemed less interesting to me, that they would be innocent victims who are suddenly struck down by something horrible. I was interested in the idea that before the language toxicity, there already was a language toxicity.
Yeah, but there's another thing going on here too as well. The parents are in a very small – well, I assume it's a small group of people who have an existence that is secret,
yeah.
separate, unique almost.
They go to synagogue out in the woods in a two-person hut.
And literally dug in a hole in the ground.
And they listen to sermons from a rabbi that come in through a radio that's a very complicated radio. It's often broken. It requires some inscrutable adjustments and maintenance. So that is another thread that comes into the book. To me, religion became very important in this novel, primarily because – well, one of the reasons is because science and medicine are looking into this problem that language is making everybody sick. It's making people leave their children behind. And I was interested in the failure of science. What happens when our trained experts are unable to help? Well, science and religion often are in a dialogue, in a kind of a battle over this. And the narrator, Sam, and his wife, Claire, are driven to their strange religious practice to look for a little more insight or perhaps some comfort from their religion. And I don't want to spoil what happens.
No, but I think we could use the term that's used. They're called forest Jews.
Yes, they are.
In a derogatory sense. By the public at large.
Well, because they practice a form of Judaism that's sort of a spin-off of Reform Judaism, and it's invented in the book, but part of their belief is that there's no reason to talk about their belief. And to me, this is actually very connected to a lot of religious ideas. If you look into Christian mysticism, mm-hmm. Jewish mysticism, language is an uneasy appliance. In other words, a mystic experience, a spiritual experience, is not often served well by language. The great mystics, in fact, said, no, let's not talk about this. I mean, you see this in Eastern religion too, really profoundly. Mm-hmm. So I sort of tried to literalize that idea a little bit. I grew up Jewish, and I've always wanted to find a way to incorporate that into a novel. You know, I was reading Philip Roth and Isaac Babel and Saul Bellow and Bernard Malamud, writers who are enormously important to me. But I wanted to find my own way in to write about my feelings of religion, my notions of religious experience. And I'm rambling a little, but another element I was interested in was to create a religion in fiction, because I sometimes think that religions are just very beautiful fictions that we've created to pursue or to address our deepest questions. Mm-hmm. And like fiction or like a novel, let's say, a religion has to be believable. It has to be compelling. It has to move us. And so I don't know if that's taking too many liberties, but that has allowed me to or driven me to want to find a way to create a religion inside a novel. Mm-hmm. And I took some elements and some seeds of Judaism, which has many offshoots, none of them exactly like the one in the book, and that's what arose. And because they keep their practice secret, they're the subject of some suspicion and some jealousy, some curiosity.
Well, historic suspicion.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I did try to tap into that a little bit, and there's a villain character named Murphy who has a special interest in what might be going on inside these exclusive, mysterious, perhaps non-existent synagogue huts in the forest.
The interesting thing about your synagogue and the rules that you've set up for this new sect of Judaism is that it only takes two people, and it's a male and female.
Yeah. Well, what I also
In fact, it's not only takes two. There can be no more than two.
Well, that is the configuration for the narrator and his wife, but I wanted to suggest that they have no information beyond themselves, that their rules obtain to them, but they actually don't know if there are other married couples or single people. And in fact, they can only go to their synagogue on a certain day of the week.
Right.
And at one point, the narrator breaks this rule and is briefly worried that he's going to stumble upon someone else who has access that particular day. So I didn't want to suggest that rule of, let's say, a man and wife was a universal one so much as one that was just part of their own rule set.
The interesting thing, of course, is this becomes a safe haven for them, this place, and literally this hovel in the ground. It's a way for them to get away from their daughter. And of course, she feels alienated because of that, you know, excluded because of that. And it's also the place where they make love.
Yeah, they do. They do.
In kind of a perfunctory fashion, but they do.
Yeah, they have most of their relations there. I honestly don't know how or why that happened.
But that apparently was where the daughter was conceived.
Yes, that's what they think.
This is Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM. Now we are in the middle of a conversation with award-winning novelist Ben Marcus about his controversial new novel, The Flame Alphabet.
Well, you know, I had them out there in the synagogue. And early on when I was writing this book, I didn't like what I was writing. I liked the information of it, but I didn't have a real scene. In other words, I was introducing the mechanism of this radio that was channeling the rabbi's sermon.
Sounds extremely complicated, and I had the feeling that it has been there a long, long, long time.
So I was trying to explain all of this stuff, but as a writer, I didn't want to explain and explain and explain because I think people get bored.
Sure.
And so I wanted there to be some dramatic action, but what is the dramatic action when two people are silently listening to something? It's quite limited in a way, and so I had to have them have sex.
Well, let's see. I can't do that. Let's see. She's left the hut, you know, in disgust early, and she doesn't listen to the second part of the sermon. Oh, okay, that's off the list, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So,
well, that brings up an interesting question, because one of those things, you know, I assume you were raised on science fiction on TV and movies as well.
Sure.
And you know that there's always that conundrum. Do you explain the amazing thing that's going on, you know, and stop the action to do that? Do you consider this a science fiction book?
Well, that struggle is an interesting one to me. I don't particularly think of it as science fiction, but I could understand if people did. Mm-hmm. And I only say I don't because I have a kind of failure to assign genres to things. And
to your own stuff or to other people's?
To anyone's. I think I like such a wide variety of writing. I like very, let's say, traditional, what might be called realist writing, Alice Munro or William Trevor. And I like an Ishiguro novel that can get very strange, mm-hmm. very otherworldly. Mm-hmm. And that interest would go back to Kafka. And you can follow it forward with all kinds of people who seem, in some sense, a little indifferent to the fences we've put up around the genres. And that would include science fiction. So I have been inspired by it. I find it interesting. But I don't know that the science fiction community would claim me, for instance. I don't know that I've satisfied.
Could you go to a science fiction convention and sell your book is the question, huh?
Would I?
I said, could you?
I don't know. I haven't been invited.
Well, somebody needs to read your book with a different mindset then.
Yeah. Well, there have been some early reviews on some science fiction websites and blogs, and I haven't really looked at them too carefully, but it's possible that that discussion is happening. I suppose I'm invoking, you know, the reader's maybe questionable right to not worry too much about the genre name and let other people decide.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I don't know if you know this, we have had Michael Chabon on the show, and he was talking about his to the Jewish Policemen's Union.
Yeah, sure.
And he did the same kind of thing you did. He created a parallel universe,
right,
if
in
you
Alaska,
will.
Yeah.
In Alaska, Sitka, Alaska.
I love that
and that's
book.
Where, you know, they set up a Jewish state, if you
yeah.
will, in after
yeah.
the collapse of Israel.
Yeah, an alternate history.
Only the timeline for that to exist is coming to an end, and that's what causes all the rife in the community. So in the same way, you have created a parallel state where the names on the map are the same.
Yeah.
But even the geography is slightly different.
Yeah. I wasn't quite content to use our exact geography. But on the other hand, I found that making up names for places was something that felt too invented and too artificial to me. It felt too otherworldly, and this was a book that, to me anyway, required belief at every turn. I had to work for believability, I felt quite driven to make everything seem real because on the face of it, there's so much that doesn't. And I think Michael Chabon is really brilliant at this. And going back to also to the question of genre and science fiction, you know, to me in some sense, he's a model of a writer who has looked at so many approaches to storytelling and made a lot of personal choices and really mastered a lot of things and fused them into something that really is his own style. And mm-hmm. in some sense, Chabon is his own genre, and it's one of my favorites because he demonstrates an appetite and an enthusiasm for the ways in which we can tell stories. And so to me, that would be something I would aspire to, so that what I was writing would show that I'm interested in a lot of different approaches, but also at the same time hoping to make a kind of soup of them that's a little bit my own soup.
I'm not familiar with your other books, so I apologize for that.
That's
but
okay.
Are there similarities in how you've approached that, or is this a standalone?
There are similarities a little bit at the level of idea. Language has been mildly poisonous in some of my earlier work. But the voice here, I think, is a little bit different. And this is, to me, more of a propelled story, a story that I hope moves quickly and develops quickly. I think I focused quite a bit more on the plot in this book. than I have in earlier books. I think I've dropped an interesting question you asked, though, now that I'm thinking.
We were talking about science fiction, and I do want to bring up one thing. Did you ever see the movie or read the book called On the Beach, Neville Shute?
No.
It's set in Australia at the time after there has been a nuclear catastrophe, either caused or accidental. And slowly this wave of radiation is descending, you know, down through the southern half. It's gone through the northern and destroyed everything. It's coming down to Australia. And the people who are there, like the people in your book, struggle for ways to how to cope with this. You know, some go to the churches and synagogues. Some go to the, you know, the medical establishment, and they're hurriedly trying to come up with the diseases. Other people are making, you know, their own radiation suits out of the tin linings that come in gum and things like that. And your people do the same thing. In fact, I want you to read something. It's from when they get together with Murphy. I call it Murphy's salve. And he also brings up a character named Lebov. It starts on 61. Now, you mentioned Murphy earlier a little bit, but he is kind of skulking around the synagogue looking for someone to come by and wandering the neighborhood at night. And they see him out the window and wonder who he is.
Yeah, and Sam is also a little bit curious of him because Murphy seems to know a little bit more than the officials do about what's going on with this language toxicity.
And by his name, he knows he's not Jewish.
Yeah. Murphy brought out the tin of grease, coating the inside of his mouth with another shining scoop of it. It smelled like jam. He held it out for me to try. If we're going to keep talking, you're going to want some of this. For protection. What is it? This? It's child's play, some basic shielding. It's been around for a while. It's pretty much lost its effectiveness for me, but I don't want to take any chances. You could rub some on your throat first. I thanked him, but declined. Still waiting for an official solution? Don't you think it's time we took matters into our own hands? The doctors are scared, right? Aren't the doctors scared? That's what I'm hearing. I looked at him, determined to show no sign I'd heard those words before, not so long ago, from Thompson. I don't think we'll get any insights from them, that's all, Murphy said. More of Thompson's exact language. He smiled at me, waited. It was like he was watching me open a present, excited to see my reaction. Murphy wasn't Jewish. There was no way he'd have access to a feed from a hole, except this was certainty based on nothing I could name, a certainty I found I had come to specialize in. I caught myself feeling curiosity about another person's faith and tried to shut it down. Whatever Murphy believed should not concern me. It would dilute my own ideas, even if presently I had none. I was not supposed to care. I knew that. I knew it. I just wish that I could have felt it, too. At the intersection, we're nearing dead ends into the synagogue prison wall. Murphy directed me out of the streetlight, and we walked down the unlit causeway toward Blister Field and the electrical tower. Are you reading Lebov? Murphy asked. Not so much, I said. Which books would be good? Murphy looked confused. Lebov doesn't write books. Books expire. Books get hacked. No one wants to leave that kind of evidence.
Books expire. Books get hacked. No one wants to leave. There's a certain bit of 1984-ness in this book, in this story.
Thank you.
Yeah. And a bit of Fahrenheit 451, too.
Thank you again.
Because this – and the Murphy character is the one who reminded me of that. You know, the Inquisitor, we'll call him.
Yeah. Yeah, it was interesting to me. I think early on I didn't realize that I would have a villain in this story. I thought it was a story of a parent making a terrible choice, having to leave and trying to find a cure for this terrible problem. But it seemed that every page I moved forward, I found myself wanting more trouble, wanting the narrator's problem not to be so simple. And I wanted his problem to keep growing and changing so that even if he seemed to be getting a hold of something, he might then be challenged with a new difficulty. And this was resolved by having this character Murphy, who in fact turns out to be more of a nemesis even than he is there. I mean, he really, I think, he evolves too to continue to haunt Sam, the narrator.
Right, but there's an experience that comes up in a few pages here that I want to have you read and share with us. It's a much more terrifying, certainly much more visceral experience. It's the one. Well, first of all, well, let's talk about how they had this discussion about developing a vaccine from the children.
Right.
And then we'll go on to the next
one. Yeah. So Murphy suggests that, look, the children are immune to this language toxicity. They're fine. Isn't the whole idea of, you know, medicine then that we would look to them to wonder what they have that we don't, so that if we extract it from them, then we might be immune too? Mm-hmm. And it's actually a fairly natural medical / scientific idea, except to Samuel, the narrator, it's horrifying.
Right.
And I think it felt horrifying to me.
Yeah.
The idea that we would start to experiment on them because they're the healthy ones.
Which is, of course, what we do.
Yeah.
When there's this new disease and somebody's immune, which they will be biologically.
We want to know why.
That's right.
Yeah. So, and that was a turning point to me in the plot when that started to come up. And I started to realize what the possibilities were going to be. And that it was one of those moments when I started to write that where I suddenly had about 30 ideas and I felt that I had to filter them. And It was interesting to then wonder how to deploy that so that it would have...
Well, you're obviously going to have a second volume. Maybe a trilogy.
Okay. All right. You heard it here.
Well, you've got this 200 words that you have, you know, pages that you haven't used. Let me go on to another time with Lvov. And the reason I gave you the setup with the salve is starts here on wait and goes to there.
Wait, he said, his head cocked, listening. I wanted to go home, get away from him, but I stopped, quieting my breath. You could hear the engines running the neighborhood homes, furnaces and water heaters droning on. Above us came a hum from the telephone lines. Murphy gripped my shoulder, raised his other hand in concentration, his eyes closed. And then I heard it, too. A din rose out of the north field beyond the school. And as the sound bloomed, it grew piercing, wretchedly clear, borne so quickly on the wind we shuddered when it hit. Voice-like, childlike, a cluster of speech blaring out of the field. The sound crushed out my air. Behind the noise ran a pack of kids, so shadowed and small at that distance they looked like animals sprinting across the field, coming right toward us. In front of them came a wall of speech so foul I felt myself burning. Murphy scrambled, grabbed me, and we ran for cover. In the bushes, I felt his cold hand in my mouth, a greasy paste spreading against my gums, his fingers reaching so far into me they touched the back of my throat. I gagged over his hand, fought to breathe. Murphy wanted to reach all the way into my lungs. I tried to relax my mouth, my throat, but I could feel my lips stretching, starting to tear. Murphy's weight was on me, his own scared breath against my neck. I gave in, exhaled, letting the man cover me, spread his medicine deep in my mouth. Then finally, Murphy pulled out his hand, wiped it on the grass next to my face. The release from this agony felt sweet, and I could breathe again. The kids cleared the field, ran past us, their voices sounding, I wasn't sure how, harmless to me now, as if I'd only imagined the effect before. The awful wave had passed through, and now I felt no acid in their speech, just kids' voices squeezed against the higher registers, sharp and annoying maybe, but safe. I had a fruity taste in my mouth, and I had to keep swallowing. The paste triggered a gush of saliva that I did not want to give up. I drank what released in my mouth and watched. Everything out on the street under the lamp seemed gorgeous and clear. One of the kids stopped on the sidewalk across the street from us. He'd caught someone, and now he was going to attack. He crouched, his hands cupped over his mouth, and he started shouting. A series of single-word cries projected through his hands as if he were launching ammunition from his face. But this was no abstract show of force. This was an attack on someone who hadn't found cover in time. Sprawled on the street beneath the boy was someone who wasn't moving, and the boy made sure of that with repeated volleys launched right over the body. A relentless flow as the body twitched on the asphalt each time the kid spoke, as if a cattle prod shot electricity from his mouth. Then the body stopped twitching, and the boy relented. When the boy stood up, we saw his face in the streetlight, so long and solemn and awful to behold. Except the kid wasn't a boy. It was my Esther. Her hair was wild, and she wore an outfit I didn't recognize, some long coat that was too big on her. From our hiding place in the grass, we watched her. "Be careful of that one," whispered Murphy into my neck. I tightened at the warning. That one. That one was my one and only. Esther looked down at the person at her feet, seemed to whisper something. Then she ran to catch up with her friends, dwarfed by her coat. On the street, that body still didn't move.
Mm-hmm. So not only do these teens now do it, they know what they're doing. They've packed together. They have become a malevolent force.
Yeah. Yeah, they've realized their power, and they're not using the power very well.
That's a polite way to put it.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking
that's a good question.
I was thinking a little bit about how long it takes for people to develop empathy. And there have been interesting pieces in the New York Times and other places about this, about children who are slow to develop empathy. And
some who never do.
And some who never do. Some adults among us never do.
It's called a sociopath.
Yeah. And but, you know, very little kids can inflict pain and not really understand that they're hurting somebody. I mean, my 3-year-old jumps off the couch and lands on my rib cage and laughs when I howl in pain. He thinks it's hilarious.
And does it again.
Yeah. It's completely enjoyable when he can make daddy scream. They're not trying to suggest that there's something evil in children whatsoever, so much as that power is difficult to handle, that people who are suddenly given such a awful power might be simply too curious to just not use it. I think it takes an insane level of maturity to refrain from using power.
Right. And when you get the pack mentality mixed into it.
Yeah.
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 That's not there.
Yeah.
Does she love her parents, Esther?
I think so. I think unquestionably so. I think that.
So unconditionally?
Well, I think that showing love is very difficult for a young person. You know, even saying I love you is mm-hmm. hard, you mm-hmm. know, I know, for a 7-year-old.
You've got this time to come. Your oldest is how old now?
Seven.
Seven, yeah. Right.
So there is a scene late in part one when I think Esther realizes some of the pain she's been causing and is trying her best not to speak around her parents and is sort of trying to be contrite when it might be a little too late. It was important to me that she not simply seem like a horrible villain. So I wanted her, if anything, to have failed to take her parents' feelings into account. Mm-hmm. You know, now when I had kids, one of the first things I felt that I really learned, if I learned anything, was what kind of son I had been and that I am to my own parents. Because I suddenly saw their project from a different perspective.
Sure.
That I just never could have seen otherwise.
I think we go through that. Hope we all do.
And, you know, that was, in some sense, revelatory but also painful and just fascinating to look at the ways and all the small ways, I guess, in which I had taken my parents for granted and also presumed a kind of safety no matter what I did. No matter what kind of, let's say, bad behavior or mean things I said, there was a kind of implicit forgiveness. It just was, they might be mad at me, but we weren't going to, you know, separate.
Right. Right.
And that idea, I think, is there with this family that it's easier for Esther to take her parents for granted. They're her parents.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the same time, too, it's not her story. She's not narrating. And I think Sam's inability to empathize in some sense with her is also, I think, a little bit tragic. But when I think about it, I think that she's suffered a lot here, too, and she loses her parents. And
well, to defend him, of course, when he comes near her and she begins and opens her mouth, he's wounded.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm doing here is taking what's already a sort of difficult, challenged family and maybe making their situation impossible.
Right. One of the ways society reacts to this, and especially when after these gangs of kids appear, is to bring out the red buses from Rochester. Do you want to read that or just talk about it?
Sure. Well, I can talk about it.
Okay.
There's some effort to quarantine children or quarantine adults. There's some confusion. There's civic confusion. You know, to me, the idea that there would be some orderly response to something so horrific was a little comical.
Yeah, but we saw what happened at Katrina, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I wanted the sense that there was, you know, kind of mixed messages coming from above, or that above itself just wasn't even there. So some buses come to collect the children and parents.
For some reason, they've been hastily painted red. What was the purpose of that?
I don't know.
You don't know? Come on.
I really
I'm sorry. You're the source here.
Red buses, it just seemed nice. You know, right. yellow buses seem too
schooly.
Yeah, and that there was some kind of metaphor there. They're just red. They've always been red, and they always will be.
In your mind. Well, they were recently painted red in the book.
They're painted red, and they collect the children, and the parents have a sense their children are going to be kept safe somewhere. There's
parents who are putting them on the bus,
And some of the kids are already alone because their parents have fled. And it's not mandatory. And, you know, later you learn that the children have been taken to a place called Forsyth, which is a kind of a research lab, and Sam, the narrator, ends up there himself.
Run by Lebov, isn't it?
Yeah, it's run by Lebov. And Sam ends up there, and it's his job to try to invent a language that won't cause illness. I had an amazing book called The History of Writing.
Ah.
A beautiful book that I was doing research from. You know, there was a lot of fascinating stuff in there. Sam does discover that, in fact, the children haven't been rescued and taken to some nice, safe place, but that there's a different...
That little ranch in the country that you send your dog to? Yes.
There's a little bit of a different purpose for a different kind of interest in the children. And so, yeah, that's pretty much what's going on there.
Right. I want to have you read something before we break, because I'm going to ask you some questions about the writing process, because I love to do that. But there is a chapter here, I guess I'll call it a chapter, in which and it's a big question, I guess. I call it Esther's final birthday cake. You know the section I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Esther has a birthday, but the parents can't even stand to be around her.
Right.
Father Sam, you know, is trying to make an effort, but his wife Claire is very ill at this point and can really not even function. And so he feels he has to try to do something and then hide so that.
That's exactly what we do. He does something and then hides. So read that to us.
When I was done, I placed the wax ball on top of the cake. It sank slightly into the silver frosting, and that was that. It didn't symbolize anything. This was the point. It was interesting to look at, and I thought that Esther might have fun holding it up to the light, wondering how dark red smoke got in there. I found Claire beneath her linen shield and helped her into the hiding place under the stairs. Her body was light in my hands these days, but if I pulled the comforter she was resting on, I could drag her as on a sled from room to room, interrupted only by the thresholds, which offered a small obstacle Claire didn't seem to mind. I did not speak, did not tell her where we were going, but she'd want to see this, her daughter's birthday. Together we could watch safely through the hole in the door our own little girl. It would be safe. Esther would come home and have some cake, and we could watch her together. I left a trail of post-its that would lead Esther to the cake, which I'd positioned on a pedestal table within view of the peephole. We'd bored a hole into the crawlspace door, and now this was our little shelter beneath the staircase. Next to the table, I pulled up the children's chair she used when she was younger. Surely she could still fit into it. And at this height, she'd be right in our line of view, provided she didn't move the chair and turn her back on us. Inside our heads, Claire and I could sing Happy Birthday. No one would have to hear. Esther wouldn't even know we were there. She could enjoy her cake, and it would be nice to be together again. I pushed Claire into our cave beneath the stairway, tucked her all the way back, then crawled in myself. Claire did not rouse herself or show much interest. When the time came, when Esther returned, walked through the house, and then found the cake, I would wake Claire and help her see. We settled onto our cushions, pulled shut the door, and waited. Claire leaned against me, seemed to whisper something, but I think she was speaking to herself. From where I sat, I could see perfectly through the peephole. That was a pretty cake on the pedestal, its little wax ball starting to sweat from the smoke. I was just fine to wait here.
That's a very emotional scene.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a parent.
Yeah.
Or grandparent.
Yeah. Well, that was, in a way, what was most important to me in this book, because it has what look like kind of these high-flying conceits, but what was important were the feelings, to make the feelings as real as possible and to really focus on the sorrow of this family. So it is an apocalyptic book in some sense, but it's in some sense I think that's a disguise for it being really a book about a family. And maybe disguise is the wrong word. It's funny because occasionally I'll be asked why I'm interested in family, and it's a stumper in a way because I wonder what else there is. I want to say what are the other topics again? Because I feel that family's fascinating to me and it's enormously important, but I also think it's where we're our most vulnerable, and you know we have a lot of joy in a family, but also a lot of sorrow and.
But it's also universal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Which is certainly a great literary device.
Yeah.
You teach. Do you teach literature?
I teach creative writing.
Creative writing.
MFA program.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you share with your students that you could share with our listeners? Semester in 2 seconds here.
If I do that, then no one will come to my program.
We won't let them hear this.
You know, first of all, I really encourage students to write exactly what they're dreaming of and what they, you know, when they sit down to write, they have a fantasy of what kind of story, let's say, they'd like to write. And I'm not trying to tell them which kind it should be. I want to read them as carefully as I can and give them good feedback. But I try to teach them urgency a little bit. That would be something I could
that's
encapsulate.
That's a good word, yeah.
Because sometimes students are simply unaware that they're being read, to sort of draw their attention to the fact that someone is sitting here looking at this line by line, and you can't wait, you can't hold back, you can't assume they'll be patient. It's your job to completely, compellingly entertain. Now, how you do that or what the nature of that entertainment is wonderfully open. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, once something's in place, we can start to evaluate if it is doing that or not. But if it's not trying, then there's a problem, right? If it's not grabbing your lapels and saying, listen, you have to listen. In other words, competing for your attention and winning over everything else, over the internet, over the TV, over your family, over your job, just actually somehow getting inside you and holding you.
Right.
And that
to go past the first 30 words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how we do that then becomes a big discussion, and we certainly look at some examples and we ask a lot of questions and we try to read each other honestly. But it's fun. It's interesting to read students and to try to talk about.
Do you read your work as you're working on it to your classes?
No.
No. You said we read to each other, so I thought, yeah. Gee whiz, that's an interesting.
No, no, no. No,
no, no.
Never,
no.
Never, never. I was using the generous we.
Oh, okay, the royal we.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I want everyone to carefully consider going out and getting The Flame Alphabet, a novel by Ben Marcus. You will not miss it in the bookstore on the shelf. Hopefully they put it face out. It is bright, what would you call them, triangles or somethings of red, blue, green, and yellow in an amazingly interesting and intricate design. It looks like layers of paper or something.
They, in fact, were layers of paper that the designer put together to look like flames.
Mm. And he took Flame Alphabet, a novel by Ben Marcus. Ben Marcus, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to a special Word by Word Conversations with Writers show where our first segment was about the Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival, scheduled for the last weekend in March. Information is available online at sebastopolfilmfestival.org. Our second segment was a conversation with novelist Ben Marcus about his controversial new novel, The Flame Alphabet. Our studio engineer for tonight's show is Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We both want to welcome you to tune in at 7 o'clock Wednesday evening, April 4th, when our conversation will be with Adam Johnson, whose captivating novel, The Orphan Master's Son, is set in the clouded reality of North Korea. Until then, we hope to see you at the 5th Annual Sebastopol Documentary Film Festival.